Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you check out everything else that 1517 is doing. You can go to the events page and check out where all the speaking events are. Chad is out and about. I mean, I'm like out and about a little bit. Chad's like out and about all the time because he doesn't have a, you know, like a six-month-old baby at home. So he just roaming the nation, bringing that good news. So check that all out. Chad, we are in Esther chapter 4. And hey, some stuff went down last episode. I mean, the plot has thickened.
Pretty thick, yeah. There's some murder in the air.
Yeah, I don't know if it's like the best, you know, this makes me wonder, like, how did you guys take over the known world with this kind of strategies? I don't know how dumb these people were that you were taking over, but this strategy, I feel like it's just been, maybe it's been a while since you had to implement a military strategic thing, but I feel like sending out mass notification of a certain day and time that you're going to kill a bunch of people is like not the way.
Don't you get the impression? I mean, we had three chapters so far that there's certain parts of the story that are, I mean, there are exaggerated to the point to where it becomes kind of darkly comic as a way of pointing fun at what the leaders are doing.
Yeah.
I mean, like that's a great example. And we saw early on, I mean, like the however long was it, a 6 month party that they had? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think a part of this is kind of a literary technique to where the Persians are being portrayed as the leadership, especially, as just ridiculously, laughably extravagant about everything. I mean, like they party to the extreme. They plan these pogroms to the extreme. You know, the whole preparation for who's going to be the chosen queen goes to an extreme. Everything is like stretched to such proportions. You look at it and you're like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, you're saying.
And I think it's kind of a way of poking fun at them.
I'm surprised it doesn't say like, and then they took a thousand parchments and they got out the gold ink and wrote this down and sent it off.
Yeah. Oh, with beautiful tapestries all around the scribes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but anyway, we're in a bad place at the end of chapter three because Haman has been offended by a single Jew, Mordecai. And so he's like, you know what I should do? Kill all the Jews.
Yeah.
And to do that, he convinces the king to sign this decree that on such and such a day, in the month, the 12th month, then this is going to go down.
And you know this is done by the opening line of chapter 4. When Mordecai learned all that had been done. Well, gee, I wonder how he figured this out. Could it have been that you wrote it down and then like sent it all over the place?
Yeah. Yeah, this was not like a private decree. This would have been known. It was published everywhere.
Yeah, it doesn't say how he learned because it's obvious. Like where it's like, well, you sent this out everywhere and then someone talked.
Yeah. Yeah, try keeping something like this quiet. Not gonna happen. So, Mordecai, who's the cousin, of course, to Queen Esther, he finds out what's happened. And he has the appropriate biblical reaction. Let's put it like that. This is the reaction we have seen multiple times. First of all, there's a tearing of clothes, the rending of garments. And we have, I don't know how many times we've seen that over the course of the podcast. And then having torn his clothes, he takes them off basically and switches his wardrobe to the wardrobe of penitence and mourning and grief and lamentation. And that is sackcloth and ashes. So sackcloth was, you know, just kind of coarse cloth. This might've been like a loincloth, something like that, made out of probably goat hair, camel hair, something rough anyway. So he takes off his regular comfortable clothing and strips down to wear this sackcloth.
Whenever I hear sackcloth, I don't know why I think of this. Probably because of the word
sack.
You think
burlap bags?
Yeah, I feel like it's like a the old school like burlap sack that you would put like a ton of potatoes in or something like that. You know, like like it's like you took one of those and you cut like two armholes and a head hole and you just like stuck that thing on your body And that's
that must have been what we were told in Sunday school back in the day, because that is the exact same image that I have. Maybe we both grew up in the South, and so that's why we think that. But every time I think of sackcloth, I picture a burlap bag
with three holes cut in it.
Yeah. In high school, I worked at a feed store, and
that's exactly the kind of bag. Yes.
Yeah, these are like burlap bags, and the worst were, so we had it's called cake. Gelato, little the shape of shotgun shells. It's protein cubes, basically. All right. And sometimes they came in 50-pound bags, but a lot of them are 100-pound burlap bags. And burlap has tiny holes in it, so stuff leaks out. And I remember stacking these things up, and you get all this junk falling all over you, and the burlap is rough. And so, anyway, that's what I think of when I think of sackcloth.
Yeah. Dude,
it would not be pleasant to wear. Let's put it that way.
No, that's a young man's job, too.
Yeah, tell me about it. Yeah, not doing that anymore. But hey, it was good when I was young. So Mordecai puts on his sackcloth and ashes. Probably we have one instance of sack of ashes being put on the head. That's probably what this happened, the way this was. So you put ashes on your head, and yeah, of course that's going to get face blackened up, and then you look miserable. You feel miserable, which is kind of the point. I mean, this is to be an outward, very, very visual expression of the fact that your heart is, you know, torn up, you're troubled, all of these sorts of things. So he puts this on, and then he says he goes into the midst of the city, and he cried with a loud and bitter cry. So you got a lot of stuff going on. I mean, he's not going to sit in silence. He's not going to sit in his regular clothes. He's changed clothes, got ashes in his head, and then he's going around with this loud and bitter cry. It must have been quite the sight. And it seems like he was going to try and get as close to Esther as he could, because we're told he went up to the entrance of the king's gate, but they wouldn't let him in because no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. I guess what? If you're going to appear anywhere close to the king, then you have to be dressed appropriately, I suppose, is the idea. You can't be going around looking like you're in lamentation and mourning anywhere close to the king. So stop right there. You can't go any closer. So verse 3 says, in every province. So, of course, this is in the capital. This is in Susa. But in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews with the expected fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. And you don't have to, it doesn't take much imagination to understand why. You find that this decree says you're all going to be massacred. This seems to be a very appropriate response to that. We're not told explicitly they were praying, but they were lamenting, which of course is what happens in lament. You cry out to God, and you have up to 40% of the Psalms are lament Psalms. So maybe that's some of what was going on. Maybe some of this was just simply kind of the, I don't know what you'd call it, but what's the word for it? Anyway, it's a kind of a wailing. Is what I'm trying to say. Yeah, so not words per se, but just this real painful kind of crying out. And this is going on all over the place. Not just Mordecai, but all the provinces are experiencing this same kind of reaction. So evidently Esther, for whatever reason, didn't know what was going on. So everybody else knows. Queen is clueless. So verse 4 says, when Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She didn't know what was going on. We'll find that out in just a minute. But when she hears about Mordecai, she knows something bad has happened, whatever it is. So she is deeply distressed. That's the way the ESV translates this. I was checking this morning on the Hebrew, and the Hebrew verb that is translated as distressed in a lot of its forms has the connotation of like a woman who is having birth pains. She's writhing in pain. So this deeply distressed is, take it at face value. She really was very, very upset about this.
And it does seem, maybe I'm wrong here, Chad, but it does seem at this point, like, so this young women and the eunuchs, they're coming and telling her about Mordecai. Cause it does seem like she learns about, like, what is really going on from Mordecai later. So I imagine this is more of a, they come and they're like, hey, and maybe, I don't know, has she shared this is a relative of hers at this point? I don't know. Who knows? But somehow she figures out that Mordecai's sackcloth and ashes and mourning and all this stuff. And so she's deeply distressed by this because this is not something you would just do for no reason. So something's going on. And then so she says, let's send some clothes out there. We got to get these sackcloth and ashes. But Mordecai is committed to the cause here.
He's very committed, yeah. Yeah, she's like, here, take these clothes to Mordecai. Tell him to take off the sackcloth and put these on. I don't know what she was thinking, you know. Was she thinking this would help him? I don't know. I mean, we're not told what's her mental game is at this point, but she's distressed.
Is it that she wants him, like, so he doesn't accept him, and then, I know we're not reading the text here, so I'm getting ahead here, but I'm just trying to figure this out. So Esther calls for someone else, one of the eunuchs, to go to him and learn what this is. Is she sending him clothes so that she can potentially say, hey, get dressed so I can call you in here and talk to you? But he's like, nah, I'm not doing that. She's like, well, I can't bring you in here to talk to you about what's going on with you doing this.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. So we did read that he could not get any farther. They stopped him. Mm-hmm. You can't come in here dressed like that. So maybe your thought is, well, okay, change your clothes and then you can come and we can have a face to face. But as we're going to see here, that's not going to happen. Not only does Mordecai refuse, but because of his refusal, then we got to have this series of this back and forth. Hey, yeah. I'm going to send this messenger. Go ask Mordecai what's going on. And Mordecai tells her, and the messenger has to come back and say, well, Mordecai says this. And then she goes, well, tell Mordecai. Well, yeah. That's it. So it's, yeah, you have this ensuing back and forth because of this. So, this eunuch that Esther calls for, Hatak, no doubt, you know, one of her closely trusted servants. These conversations had to be kept private. So she sends him. He'd been appointed to her, and she said, okay, go to Mordecai and figure out what's going on here. So literally to learn what this was and why it was. In other words, okay, he's not going to take he's obviously very upset because of what he's wearing. And he's obviously more upset than I realized because he's not going to change his clothes. So go give me the scoop, find out what's going on. So Hatak, verse 6, went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and of the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. So he kind of brings him up to speed on everything that's been going on. Yeah, well, you know, I wouldn't bow down to Haman. He gets really upset. Then Haman goes to the king, and they come up with this whole decree, and Haman promises to pay the king.
That is actually pretty wild, because it'd be one thing to know about the decree because they did a terrible job keeping it a secret. But he knows, like, all the detail. He, like, somehow Mordecai knows exactly how this went down.
Yeah. Yeah, he's either an official who is privy to some of these things, or he's just a really good listener, or he's got people maybe who are his ears. Who
got
are
that whistleblower.
Yeah. Well, you know, people like to talk, right? People like to talk. So I'm sure word got around, hey, did you hear? Oh, yeah, did you hear? And so kind of pass from person to person. So Mordecai finds out all this, and so not only does he relay this verbally to the eunuch so the eunuch could take it to Esther, but also he gave him a copy of the written decree that was issued in Susa for their destruction so that he could show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her. Well, this is the part that is maybe a little bit unexpected. She's queen, right? I mean, she's obviously a powerful figure. And Mordecai is going to come along and say, not only, all right, this is what happened, and here's the decree, but you tell the queen what to do. You tell the queen that Mordecai tells her to do this, and what he tells her is command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. So, you know, it doesn't matter how powerful your child or your foster child, I suppose, in this case, gets, you do feel as kind of a parent, you can still kind of say,
tell,
hey.
Tell them what to do.
Yeah. I know you're the president and all, but yeah, here's what you need to be doing. So I'm with you, of course. I mean, this needs to happen. Okay. So that's the kind of the first part of this ensuing conversation. So the eunuch, Hatak, he went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. This would have been a lot easier if Mordecai had actually come to visit with Esther. But anyway, he goes and tells Esther what Mordecai had said. So Esther spoke to Hatak and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, quote, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know. So this is common. Everybody knows this. That if a man or a woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, so if you just like show up, walk in, and the king has not summoned you, there is but one law: to be put to death, except the one, so there's one exception here, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. So she says that, and then she has one more thing to say. She says, oh, and by the way, so we all know this is the law. And by the way, as for me, I haven't been called to I have not been called to come into the king for 30 days. So not the safest situation for me to go into. This is her first reaction. She says, well, I understand that you want me to go to the king to beg his favor. And I understand that you want me to plead with him on behalf of our people. I mean, I get that. But here's the situation. If I do this, then I am putting my own life on the line. And I mean, I don't even know what the king's thinking of me right now. I haven't seen the guy in 30 days, which is kind of a weird husband and wife. I mean, we're not, you got to put yourself in this situation. You know, we don't summon our spouses. I know I haven't seen you in 3 or 4 weeks. So I need you to come see me. It just doesn't work that way. But that's the way this worked here. And especially with polygamy. I mean, I don't know how many wives and concubines this guy had. So,
well, I mean, it tells you two things. One, like, yeah, I'm not sure how, is he like lost interest in me? Like, I don't know. I haven't seen him in a month. The other thing is that you also, because you haven't seen him in 30 days, you can't just be like, all right, next time he calls me in, I will definitely bring this up. Because you don't, it could be who knows how long.
It could be 30 more days. Yeah. Yeah. She has no idea. So, We found out what Mordecai said. Now we found out what Esther says back to Mordecai. And now we'll come to, well, no doubt the most well-known section of the book of Esther. And rightly so. I mean, this is one of these moments that is unforgettable. So verse 12, they told Mordecai what Esther had said. They told him, I guess there's more than one in this group that's going out to talk back and forth. So they let him know here. Let Mordecai know what Esther had said. So Mordecai told them to reply to Esther. So here's what he says. Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. Now, I don't know if Esther had thought about that or not. Maybe she thought that she was safe and she's the queen after all. But this is the way that he's going to deal with her hesitation. So first of all, I mean, he goes about this two or three different ways. But the first point is, listen, don't forget, you're a Jew. I mean, you may be the queen, but legally speaking, you fall under the same decree that all of us other Jews fall under. So yes, you have kept that hidden. You have kept your identity hidden up to this point. But don't think that just because you're in the king's palace that you're going to escape more than all the other Jews.
Well, there's one of the reasons this could be true, because you might be like, well, why? I mean, if they kill all the Jews and nobody knows she's a Jew, how is anyone ever going to find out? Like, I mean, this seems like you're probably never going to be found out. Yeah, until they start, like, it's not as though she's the only person in the world that knows she's a Jew. I'm assuming she knows people. I'm assuming that, like, Mordecai knows people. You think when they're like rounding up all these Jews to kill them, maybe somebody's going to be like, hey, you do know the queen's a Jew?
Yeah.
Because other people do, like the Jews know this, at least some of them.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. There's no way that they didn't know. I mean, people would have known Mordecai and Esther before Esther was called up for the beauty pageant. Yeah, so they knew her. And yeah, somebody's gonna talk. Somebody somewhere along the way, in the midst of the fear, the confusion, the rounding everything up, the murder, somebody's gonna say something.
Yeah, it would be very natural.
If nothing
too.
Else, maybe they'll try and rescue their own life by saying, "Hey, well, I got some information.
I'm friends with the queen. I'm cousins. I'm cousins to the queen. I don't know, whatever. Like, I grew up with the queen."
Sure, sure.
She's gonna be real upset if she finds out you killed me. Like, yeah, I mean, are people gonna do this stuff?
So, so don't think just because of who you are and where you're at, you're going to be safe. Then verse 14. If you keep silent at this time, so if you don't go in and see the king, if you don't say something, if you don't plead for mercy, if you keep silent, relief and deliverance will rise from the Jews from another place. Now, this is one of the definite places in the book of Esther where people will say, okay, you know, the name of God is not mentioned explicitly, but there are allusions to this. And this is a primary place where this is brought up. And some people will even make the argument, even though I don't think it holds water, that the Hebrew word that is used here for place, which is makom, is actually an alternate way of referring to God. And the reason they say that is much later in Jewish history, they had several different expressions that they would say instead of the name of God. Like, you may have heard Hashem, which means the name. Okay. Another one that Jews have sometimes used is Hamakom, which means the place. And these are just surrogates for the name of God because, you know, as almost everyone knows, people, Jews and some Christians, do not want to use the divine name. And so they come up with all kinds of surrogate names for God. Anyway, one of those is Hamakom, which means the place. And so some people made the argument that really what Mordecai is saying here is if you keep silent, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from Hamakom, that is, from God. We don't have any evidence that the place as a surrogate name for God was used at this early date. So I think it's just simply him saying, listen, if you don't do this, well, then we'll get relief and deliverance someplace else. God is going to make this happen for us.
Yeah.
In other words, but you and your father's house will perish. And by that, I assume that he means it's going to be too late. So we'll get relief and deliverance. God's going to make this happen one way or another, but it's probably going to be too late for us.
At the very least, this seems like Mordecai is a guy, even though God's not ever mentioned in this book or anything like that. The only way to say something like this, like, hey, if you don't help us, deliverance will come from somewhere. The only way to say that with confidence is to be sort of a believer in promises.
Mm-hmm.
Why else would he say that? I mean, like, there's, if you don't believe that God has made certain promises that he is obligated to keep because of who he is, you have no reason to say, well, if you don't do it, trust me, it will happen. Like, why?
Yeah. On what basis do you make that? Make that statement. Right. Yeah.
You're appealing to something here.
Yeah. If you didn't have this kind of confidence, you'd simply say, well, if you keep silent this time, we're done.
Yeah.
You are our only hope. If you don't do this, it's all over. No, you say relief and deliverance arise from another place. If you know Israel's history, if you know the Psalms, if you know all these various ways in which God has stepped in and rescued his people before. I mean, just this morning, the book I'm working on right now is a 365-day devotional on the Psalms. I'm about halfway done with it. And yesterday, or this morning, actually, way early this morning, I was writing on one of the Psalms that talks about how you have a coalition of forces, enemy forces, that are ganged up against Israel, okay? And the way that Asaph, who's the author of the psalm, responds to this is by saying in this prayer to God, do to them, O God, just like you did to like the Midianites and the other peoples who attacked us in the past. In other words, we know that you have we know in the past you have done great things for your people. And we know that you have promised to be with us. You know that we know you have promised to defend us. So, in other words, do now what you've done in the past. So the reason Asaph can say that is because, just like you said with Mordecai, he knows God's promises. He knows that God has a consistent consistent history of dealing with his people in a gracious and compassionate sort of way. And he certainly knows that Israel had to survive. I mean, Israel had to survive because they were the bearers of the capital T, the promise of the Messiah who was to come. So there's no way that anyone could have completely wiped out the nation of Israel, because these are the sons and daughters of Abraham, and they're passing forward the promise of the seed until the seed is born a few centuries after this.
Yeah, it almost reads like he's saying God is going to deliver us. It seems that he would like to use you to do this, but if you refuse, he will do it another way.
You're not his only option. Yeah. And I mean, it's a very strong argument. It's a very strong argument. So first of all, don't think that you're going to get off scot-free. So there's kind of a threat there, right? And then he follows this up with a promise. So you got the threat. You yourself could die, Esther. Then he's got the promise. Listen, we've got a God who is always going to provide relief and deliverance for us. And then he ends with this perfect sentence. And this is probably the sentence from Esther that everybody knows. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?
Yeah. So this is like God is the one who placed you here. This is the plan to save the Jews. If you refuse, his arm is not short, as the Old Testament language would say. But this is his preferred method right now.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is not, of course, the same story, but basically like the story of Joseph, right?
Yeah.
This line could have been delivered to Joseph when he's in prison. Joseph, you're put here for such a time as this. You know, interpret that dream, do this, do that, and God's going to use you to deliver his people. And you never know. I mean, this is a big deal, of course. This is a threat to the whole nation of Israel, but I mean, we're in these situations all the time. Who knows whether you met this particular person, or you had this particular conversation, or you offer this word of encouragement, or you gave forgiveness to someone, because it was in that exact moment that God wanted you to be in order that you could do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've all experienced these situations where, I mean, there's no way that we could have known that because we did A, then B, C, D, E, all these other things would have happened. But we can trace it back to, hey, God put me right there in that position, in that relationship, in that conversation, whatever it might have been, because that's exactly what he was going to use in order to begin a whole string of other things that were for the good of others, or for my good, or for the common good, whatever that might have been. That's the way that providence works.
Yeah. I do like that. This is a pretty good argument. So Mordecai drops a great line, probably the most well-known line in Esther. Esther's going to drop probably the next most well-known line after this to him. So she does do the, all right, this is a pretty good argument. You did for such a time as this. That seems like pretty epic language that you're using there. So I'm going to have to go along with it. But now let me flip it and remind you that also I'm the queen. So let me give a couple of commands here if we're going to do this.
Yeah. Don't discount the human part of this, right? It's Mordecai basically trying to still boss around the queen. You remember when you were a little girl and I told you what to do. You still do what I tell you to do. So she's like, well, okay, but remember, Mordecai, I'm still queen, so I get to tell you and everybody else what to do. So Esther told them, all right, well, you go back to Mordecai. Here's what I wanted to tell him. Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf. So this is primarily directed to a fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. That's serious.
Yeah. No eating for 3 days is not that big a deal. No drinking for 3 days is dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, to my knowledge, is the only time this has happened. Most of the time, even if you have like a annual fast, like on Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, you fast, but you fast from sunup to sundown. Same thing that the Muslims do during the month of Ramadan. They don't fast all during the night. They just fast during the day, sun up, sun down. So that's typically the way that fasting works. But no, she says, listen, 3 days, no eating, no drinking, night or day. I and my young women will do just as you do. We will fast also. And then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And here's a great line. If I perish, I perish.
Yeah, that's the one.
I don't think this is. Yeah, I mean, this is courage. So I know it's the right thing to do. And you told me it's the right thing to do. So I'm going to do it. But I also want you to do everything connected with fasting in order that our prayers might be answered, that God would grant success to this possible death that I'm walking into courageously.
This is like, back in my youth, in a different tradition, of course, this would be like, all right, I'm going to need you to send a message out to the prayer warriors because I'm going to need a lot of prayer covering going on for this little endeavor.
Yeah. I think if I were in her situation, I had that kind of authority, I'd be having everybody fast too. Yeah. Like, all right, a 3-day fast for Chad.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know if a hedge of protection is a real thing, but if it is, I could really use one of those.
We're going to go that route this time because my life is on the line. So Mordecai went away, we're told, and did everything as Esther had ordered him. So he's going to do, she's going to do what he suggested, and he's going to do what she commanded. So they do this. Then first part of chapter 5, going to put us on the day. So on the third day, which I find interesting because they're supposed to fast 3 days, night and day. And she said they're going to also.
Shocking that it's on the third day that she's like, let me go and do this thing on the third day.
On the third day, yeah. I love these third days in the Old Testament. We've seen a bunch of them. And as I always remind people, God likes to do big things on the third day.
Yeah, well, Esther's going to go to, I mean, this is cool. She's going to go to war with the plan of Satan to destroy the promises of God. She's going to go do that on the third day. She's going to go fight death on the third day. It's pretty good.
Yeah, and live.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's going to put her life out there and live. I mean, I love how you see these themes of crucifixion and resurrection and salvation and divine providence and God putting just the right people in just the right times and places everywhere. Yeah.
You know who else didn't eat for 3 days when they were fighting death? Jesus. So there's not a lot of eating and drinking going on in the tomb.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait till you have that resurrection feast later.
That's it.
All right. So chapter 5, third day. Esther put on her royal robes, get dressed up. And she does what she said she'd do. She stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. So a lot of details there as to where everything was located, which, you know, if you live there, no doubt you would know where all of these different places were located. And the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court. So here's the moment of truth. And she told him, the law is, unless the king says basically, you know, okay, you're good, extends the golden scepter, then this could be it for you. So a moment of truth. He sees her standing in the court, and we're told she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. I wonder if it was an audible sigh of relief that she released in that moment, or she held it together. I cannot imagine being in a situation like that where I'm about to do something. I'm walking into something that's going to go one or two ways, either really, really bad or really, really, or possibly really, really good. That's where she's at.
Yeah. And you would assume that this sort of law, cause you're like, man, what a harsh law. I mean, like if you make a mistake and walk in, use the wrong door, walk into somewhere, like you better hope you're someone the king likes because this could go real bad. You assume that this sort of thing is like, this is a rule to avoid any sort of assassination attempts, things like that. Like you can't walk in here, man. And the way it describes it is that like he's out here over here and you got to enter from way back here. Like this is probably also mm-hmm. for this reason. So there's like some distance. You got to assume there's a bunch of people with armed that are in there mm-hmm. and they're just waiting to know whether they're supposed to strike this person down or let them approach you.
Let them walk in. Yeah.
That's intense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So don't picture like the king is alone. He's sitting on his throne and there's this vast empty space between him and whoever the person is that's approaching him.
No.
Plenty of people with weapons around and ready and capable of using them should the need arise. So he holds out the golden scepter. No doubt Esther breathes a sigh of relief. She approaches, touches the tip of the scepter. All of this was just ceremony, of course. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, even to the half of my kingdom."
I feel like this half the kingdom business is like some kind of saying that has like no weight to it. I mean, like,
oh, absolutely.
Like this happens all the time. And you're like,
stereotypical saying. Yeah. Like it's ever actually going to be followed. It, like someone's going to say, "Well, I do kind of like the eastern half of your kingdom. If you would,
I mean, I'll give you up to my half of my kingdom." Well, you know, I was just going to ask, what, you know, if I could take a vacation to the countryside, but you know what? I'll take it.
Now that you offer, of course, that's the very language that's used by Herod, right? Which leads to the request for the head of John the Baptist.
It feels like this must just become some kind of saying. It's like, "Hey, I like you." You know, I don't know if you just say this kind of thing to women. It's just some kind of like they know that women can't have half the kingdom, so it don't matter if you say that you give it to them. Like, "I'll give you up to half the kingdom. I'll take it." Well, you know, the law doesn't let me do that. Like, I don't know what the deal is.
Maybe so. Yeah, I think it's just like it. It's just, yeah, it's a stereotypical extravagance. Yeah, I really like it. What do you want? I give you half my kingdom.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds to me like something somebody would say when they're rich and drunk these days. Yeah, what do you want? I'll
to a pretty girl.
A couple houses. Yeah. I'll give you whatever you want. So she says, she doesn't ask for half the kingdom. She probably surprises him. At least it's surprising to me. She doesn't say, "Yes, King. If you don't mind canceling that decree about the Jews." Esther's too smart for that. She's going to set up. First of all, this is a very public setting.
Yep.
I mean, she's not going to say, "Hey, I know that you were so stupid as to be tricked by Haman into signing a decree that was going to exterminate a whole group of people." Of course, she's not going to insult him. Nor is she going to ask for something like this for him to go back on something that he said. She's going to work this very, very wisely. She says, "Well, if it please the king, you come over for dinner and bring Haman with you. Let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I prepared for the king." pretty smart. So the king said, "Well, let's get ready. Bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther has asked."
Yeah, he's just like, "This is a great idea." Yeah, like, you know, he's a feast kind of guy. We established that right from the jump. So he's like,
"Oh yeah,
like, you know what? I like this. My queen's coming in here, like saying, 'Hey, I think you need to do some eating and drinking.'" He's like, "Man, this I picked the right one."
Yeah, I'm all about that. I love my dinners, love my wine. So the king and Haman they go to the feast. Esther had everything prepared. They're sitting around, they're drinking wine and. The king's like, I guess the king is like, what is it what you want? I mean, what's your wish? It's going to be granted to you. I mean, just tell me I'll give you half the kingdom. He repeats it again. Half the kingdom. It's going to be fulfilled. And then Esther, she follows this up. She's getting everything ready, which we'll get to later. But wrapping up this section, once more, she says, "Well, my wish, my request is just this. If I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleased the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman," she includes him, "the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for him, for them. And tomorrow I will do as the king has said." She's building this up. She's going to get everything just right before she actually tells the king what it is that she wants. Now, the funny thing is, I think it's kind of hilarious, the section that follows, which we'll get to in the next episode. Of course, Haman is eating this up.
Oh, dude, Haman's
Don't you know his head's about to burst?
The queen's invited me to back-to-back feasts. Like, this, I am, like...
Only me. Yeah, me and the king. We're super tied. Even the queen wants me around. Oh, yeah. It's great. So, anyway, Esther lives, obviously. She's getting everything ready for the great disclosure. So we'll get to that in next episode or the one after that.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, that is it. We are out of time, so we'll leave it right there. Next week we will we'll get to talk about Haman. He's just feeling a little too good, making dumb decisions. And so we'll get into that next episode. I'll see you then, Chad.
See you then.